Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
My guest this week is the chairman of the 1922 Committee and Conservative Member of Parliament for Altrincham and Sale West, Sir Graham Brady. Sir Graham, thank you for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Nice to see you.
Now, before we discuss some of the lockdown restrictions that are still in place at the moment, I want to ask you about some of the ongoing events in Afghanistan. And the situation has seriously deteriorated in recent days. What are your thoughts on what's happening at the moment and the current evacuation efforts?
Well, obviously, it's an impressive effort to evacuate in very difficult circumstances. But the tragedy is that the difficulty of those circumstances was avoidable. And clearly, a more measured, better planned drawdown of troops, leaving the Afghan forces in a position to keep control of the country, would have been far preferable. And, you know, I just think over the last few years, where really the US and coalition forces in Afghanistan haven't been actively engaged as combat units, they've mostly been there training and facilitating the Afghan forces, has actually been a very effective effort, which did a remarkably good job. And it's been quite shocking to see the speed with which the withdrawal of that support has led to the Afghan forces simply collapsing.
And it's clear that the sense of feeling from your colleagues across the House of Commons is that the blame for this rapid deterioration lies with President Biden. How do you think the special relationship between the UK and the US has been affected by the withdrawal?
Well, I think that clearly it was a US-led decision. Decision to withdraw US forces had been taken by President Trump, but then supported by the new President Biden. The pace of the withdrawal and the failure to maintain order and control while it was taking place, I think clearly is something for which the current administration bears responsibility. The relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States is a critically important one, and it's one that we have to maintain and keep in good shape. I think obviously this is an unfortunate episode. It's unfortunate that the United Kingdom wasn't able to persuade President Biden to handle this differently. I understand that the British government was urging the Americans to withdraw more slowly, and they didn't pay heed to what we were requesting.
Let's move on to look at something a little bit closer to home, and that's the current COVID-19 restrictions that are still in place. Now, we were told on the 19th of July that would be our Freedom Day, but a number of the regulations still remain in place today. What do you see as the reasoning for this when the infection and death rates around the virus seem to be at a fairly stable rate at the moment?
I think there's an awful lot of inertia. I think when any government takes a huge amount of control and power over the population, there's always a danger that government will want to hold on to some of those powers, that control that it's taken. And this is always a danger right from the outset when Parliament granted the government emergency powers initially, when we were being told it was for a three-week lockdown in late March 2020. And that lockdown went on for 3 months, not 3 weeks. We had three lockdowns. Many of us, my constituents here in Altrincham, had also very heavy restrictions in place from the summer of last year as well. So for large parts of the British public, we were under very intense restrictions for almost the whole of that sort of 15, 16 month period. Most of the restrictions have now gone, but the emergency powers remain. And I think that is a concern if, as I expect, the government comes back and seeks to extend the Emergency Coronavirus Act for a third time, to take it up for a full 2 year period. That would be a cause for serious concern. The government's rhetoric, and indeed the rhetoric of the medical and scientific advisors to government, is that we have to recognise that COVID-19 is now an endemic virus. It's something with which we have to live. Now, when we are finding a way to live with a virus, that surely has got to be for all of us as individuals to make our own judgments what level of risk we find acceptable. Government can give the best advice. It's done a good job in making sure that there is a good supply of vaccines, that more vulnerable people have generally been vaccinated. So the level of risk from the virus has been greatly reduced. We now need to make that big sort of paradigm shift back from a world in which people sit waiting for Boris Johnson or for, well, obviously no longer Matt Hancock, but for Sajid to make decisions for them about what they can do in their lives. We've got to move back to a world where we have responsibility for our own lives, make decisions for ourselves and our own families.
And you mentioned that the government does want to move to a position where we are living with the virus. But one of the aspects of the policy at the moment is to introduce a domestic vaccine passport for certain venues to access certain venues. Do you agree with this measure?
No, I don't. And you know, I think it's both wrong in principle to have an approach which is so discriminatory as a vaccine passport would be. It's also entirely senseless. All of the evidence now suggests that whilst the vaccines are very effective in stopping the people who are vaccinated from becoming seriously ill with COVID, the evidence is also that the vaccines don't stop people from becoming infected or from passing the infection on. So there's no reason to believe that simply requiring people to be vaccinated to go to certain settings would contain the rate of infection or transmission of COVID.
If the vaccine passports are made mandatory for certain venues, and a number of your colleagues in the House of Commons, and particularly in the Conservative Party, have been very vocal in their opposition towards this, as you have been. But based on that, would you be following a number of your colleagues in Parliament in boycotting the party conference in Manchester in 5 weeks' time if this is introduced?
Well, we still don't know what the Conservative Party's policy is in relation to the conference. And, you know, as chairman of the 1922 Committee, I sit on the board of the Conservative Party. But when I asked whether there would be an expectation of vaccination for attending the conference, I as yet have had no response. So my assumption is that they won't take that action, that people will be able to attend the conference, whether they are vaccinated or not. As I've said, all of the logic and the evidence suggests that there's really no reason to have vaccine passports. Hopefully that will have been accepted more widely by the time of the conference. My current intention isn't to boycott the conference. I've got various things that I've been asked to speak at and around the conference, and I intend to do that. And I'll do what I can to continue making the case for good, freedom-loving Conservative policies.
The Prime Minister announced earlier in the summer that he intended to make COVID-19 vaccination mandatory to access certain venues like nightclubs and cinemas in order to increase the take-up amongst younger people. And the amount of young people taking the vaccine doesn't seem to be as high as in other age groups. Again, do you agree with this measure?
No, I don't. I think that medical interventions or vaccinations or other treatments have got to be a matter of personal choice. Clearly, the vaccines that were developed very rapidly seem to have a very good efficacy in preventing people from getting very seriously ill with COVID. We do also know, though, that they cause some quite serious adverse reactions in a small percentage of cases. We've just seen the case of a relatively young BBC presenter who died as a result of blood clotting that followed from the COVID vaccination. I think for people who are more vulnerable, and the degree of vulnerability increases markedly the older people are, there's a very strong and obvious case for vaccination. I'm 54. I took the view that it made sense for me to get the vaccination earlier in the year. But I certainly don't think we should be trying to coerce people who should be balancing those questions of risk themselves.
Do you think there's ever a point at which public health should supersede liberty?
I think that there probably is. This is, you know, it's a fascinating and important question. I don't think many people would say that liberty is an absolute. There are circumstances which we all accept that government or other authorities might exert some control. You know, an obvious example is when there's a bomb discovered in a car in a street, and we pretty much accept that it's reasonable for the police to cordon off the street whilst an action is taken. But I think the experience of the last 18 months really has forced people to start to interrogate this question in a little bit more detail. It's one thing to have liberty taken away for a very short and specific period of time for a very specific purpose. In March 2020, we were told that there was a very serious danger, the NHS could be completely overwhelmed very quickly, that people might die both of COVID and of other conditions because of that. And we were told that there was a case for a three-week lockdown during which urgent action would be taken to increase NHS capacity. And we saw those Nightingale hospitals put in place. They were virtually unused as it happened, but that additional capacity was put in place. That was answering the purpose that had been articulated for that original lockdown. We then saw mission creep to the extent that it was often seemed to be the case that ministers were actually looking to eliminate COVID completely. And if it meant that people couldn't see their families, people couldn't start relationships, people couldn't have Christmas together, whatever it might be, then that was the price worth paying. So, you know, I certainly would be prepared to accept there are times when for a short period, for a very specific purpose, you might have some constraints put on freedom. But the idea that you would have a whole new approach to life where government indefinitely would constrain people's freedom to make their own decisions and run their own lives in order to try to eliminate a virus. All of the evidence, I think we have to say now, is that lockdowns don't actually work in eliminating the virus. You need to look now at what's happening in New Zealand and Australia, which completely cut themselves off from the world and haven't managed to avoid the growth of either COVID-19 or indeed the Delta variant of COVID. So, you know, I certainly think we need to ask very serious questions before allowing government to take that kind of control over our lives again.
Well, you just mentioned there the actions taken in Australia and New Zealand, and in particular in the last few weeks, they seem to have taken action that's very drastic after just one or two cases being discovered. Full regions and even the whole country has gone into full lockdown, and some of the responses to that have been just extraordinary, really. I mean, one area in Australia notably going as far as to put down rescue animals so that people don't travel to go and collect them. I mean, do you worry that such draconian behavior might migrate over here if there is another lockdown?
Well, we've had some pretty draconian in the United Kingdom over the course of the last 18 months. It's important that we remember some of those instances of people being arrested or threatened with arrest for sitting on a park bench. The two women who'd gone for a socially distanced walk in the Peak District who were harassed by a police drone when clearly they were doing no harm to themselves or to anybody else. There were many examples. In Greater Manchester, there was an instance where a small child's birthday party that was going on in the front garden of their home was broken up by the police. It's obvious whether you're in the United Kingdom or Australia or wherever, there are people who will take these things to absurd extremes, who will allow the exercise of extreme powers to get out of hand. I think we've had plenty of wake-up calls over the last 18 months. People really ought to understand that liberty is a very fragile, very precious thing. And unless people stand up for it and stand up for their own human rights, then some authorities will take things to outrageous extremes.
I'd like to move on to look at another aspect of the COVID restrictions at the moment, and to look at one of the worst affected sectors throughout the whole of the pandemic has been the travel industry. And your constituency is very close to Manchester Airport, the third busiest airport in the whole of the UK. What impact has that had on the local economy where you are?
It's very difficult to know. Of course, we're still in the furlough arrangements. There are a lot of people whose jobs have been protected to a degree by furlough arrangements. That will wind down during the course of September. And I think the effect may become more painfully apparent at that point. But clearly, the airport and the aviation sector massively important for the local economy here, but also for the wider Greater Manchester area and the whole of the northwest of England. It's a big economic driver, and that international connectivity critical for many, many different businesses and industries and exporters and so on. The effects will be quite considerable unless we can get things moving again and get things moving quite soon. I fear that we've already lost a very large part of the summer tourism market, which was something that a lot of the aviation industry was desperately hoping to get up and running. We really need some clarity and some common sense, and getting rid of some of these excessive and excessively expensive tests that people have to take would be a very important step.
And of course, one of the remaining restrictions still in place around international travel is the traffic light system. And over the last couple of months, there have been some serious issues around the allocation of certain countries, which category they should be placed in. Do you think it is an effective enough system at keeping the virus out of the country and preventing other variants from entering the UK?
I think what we've seen in international terms is that you can't keep the from moving around the population across the world. And you know, again, Australia and New Zealand, which effectively had closed borders for the last 18 months, haven't kept the Delta variant out of their countries. For a country like the United Kingdom, we are very connected, we're very international, we trade a lot with the rest of the world, we travel a lot around the world. And I don't think it's realistic to think you could close our borders in the way that the Australians have done in the United Kingdom. But I think also we need to again recognise the benefits of the vaccination programme for those who are most vulnerable are to give the individual protection. So if we are much safer and the number of people getting very seriously ill is much lower than it was, the number of people dying is much, much lower than it was, then we ought to be ready to take some of the benefits of that protection by opening up and living life again.
Now, I'd like to move away from looking at the COVID restrictions and look a little bit more into your role as chairman of the 1922 committee. Now, for listeners who aren't fully aware of what the 1922 committee is, can you outline what it does and what some of your responsibilities are as its chairman?
Yeah, really, the 1922 committee is the Parliamentary Conservative Party. And you know, we just happen to have an interesting, quirky, historical name, which arose from the fact that it was the Conservative intake from the 1922 general election, which first formed the committee. It gradually developed to be a committee of all Conservative backbench members of Parliament. So we have a number of different functions. Again, I guess by evolution, we've added various things over the years. The core of it really is keeping the backbench Conservative MPs in touch with the leader of the party, in touch with members of the cabinet, or if we're in opposition, obviously the leader of the opposition, the shadow cabinet. So a lot of communication, whether it be bringing the prime minister or other ministers to come and speak to colleagues and take their questions, to be exposed to a little bit of scrutiny in a more private environment than would happen in the chamber of the House of Commons, for instance. But also, we have an elected executive. There are 18 members of the executive, six officers, and 12 other executive members. So we are, in a sense, the elected representatives of our colleagues, which I think gives us a role in expressing the views, the concerns, raising issues internally with the leader of the party, with the chairman of the party, with the chief whip. Every Wednesday after the main meeting of the 1922 committee, I and the other officers of the 22 will go and meet with the chief whip, and we can have very full, wide-ranging discussions, passing on concerns that have been raised in the executive or in the main meeting. We then have taken on some other functions as the Conservative Party has now got a constitution since, I think it was 1998. The role of the 1922 committee was codified at that point in regard to leadership elections and votes and confidence in leaders of the party, which has kept me busy on one or two occasions in the last 11 years that I've been chairman of the 22. And we also, now that the House of Commons elects the members of parliamentary select committees, that's a function that we undertake as well. So we've got a sort of odd mixture of different roles, but at its core, it's about representing the views, concerns, interests of backbench Conservative MPs internally to the leader. I often say to people, the chairman of the 1922 committee, who normally will see a Conservative prime minister or leader on quite a regular basis and can have private conversations, is the only advisor that a Conservative leader has, whom the leader hasn't chosen himself or herself. And I think that's quite a good thing, to have that private channel of communication. And you know, none of the three Conservative prime ministers with whom I've dealt over the last 11 years has ever had a problem with anything that we've discussed leaking, finding its way into the press. They know that it's a completely private conversation, and to be able to have that conversation with somebody who will be prepared to tell you things you don't want to hear, I think is quite valuable.
And I mean, you mentioned there the private relationship that the chairman of the 1922 committee has with the party leader, and in this case, it's the prime minister. And that position became most notable to the public during the 2017 to 19 parliament, when, of course, Brexit caused so much tension across the House of Commons and really divided the Conservative Party. How difficult was it to communicate the parliamentary party's views to Theresa May and her government when MPs were so divided and there was such clear opposition to her plans?
Well, what I've always tried to do is give party leaders as good a sense as I can of the balance and the spectrum of opinion within the parliamentary party. So, of course, I will sometimes say, this is what I think. And I, you know, I think that's quite important if you're going to be trusted to be objective as well, then making it clear what my own views are, I think is a part of that. But there are times when I'll say, well, this is what I think very strongly, but you know, I've got to say that 75% of colleagues take a different view. And you know, the government will get whatever measure through very easily because of that. Of course, difficult when there was that massive rancor and division, but in a way, more important than ever to be able to give both a sense of the balance of opinion and also from time to time to be able to try to help to find a way through. And you know, I told Theresa May straight away when she came back with her draft withdrawal agreement that the Northern Ireland Protocol was simply not going to be acceptable to the House of Commons. And then I tabled my amendment in 2018, in the January, I think it was, to try to indicate that the House of Commons was prepared to support the withdrawal agreement if you had alternative arrangements for the Irish border in place. So I guess they were very unusual circumstances, but being able to try to find a course which would bring almost all Conservative colleagues together was, I hope, was a helpful contribution.
And those alternative arrangements that you proposed to the withdrawal agreement, at the time, there seemed to be a lot of speculation about what alternative arrangements really means. I mean, at the time, there was the backstop, which was flatly rejected. But since then, since Boris Johnson took over as Prime Minister, he's replaced the backstop with an arrangement that has caused a number of issues around the Irish border and trade from the island of Ireland to Great Britain. In your mind, when you tabled that amendment, what was your view of what the alternative arrangement should be?
Well, I think an awful lot of this is about goodwill on both sides. And some of the problems that have occurred, I think, are because of the EU side interpreting the agreement in a rather unhelpful way and maximising the number of controls and inspections which are undertaken. If you were able to assume a degree of goodwill on both sides, that there was an active effort to make the border as insignificant as possible, then that would be really quite easy to achieve. Certainly at the moment, all of the regulatory standards for the UK are the same as those in the EU. There's no fundamental reason why goods crossing into Northern Ireland from mainland GB should be subject to regulatory inspection. And you know, most borders, including the Irish border, operate in a very low-key way most of the time. And nearly all of the traffic that crosses that border, for instance, is regular, big movements of goods, a huge amount of Guinness moving from the Republic to Northern Ireland, for instance. And the hauliers who are moving these goods simply fill in the paperwork online. There's only an inspection at or near a border if there's any reason to suspect that there's some bad practice going on, somebody's trying to smuggle something or whatever. And that's normally an intelligence-led approach. So, you know, I think all of this is eminently doable. There just has to be a real will to make it work, and I hope we'll get that.
And just to come back to looking around at your role as the 1922 committee chair, In December 2018, when the Conservative MPs held that no confidence vote in Theresa May as party leader, how difficult was that meeting that you had with her to inform her that the required number of signatures for such a vote had been met, and especially given that you'd both been elected in the 1997 intake?
Yeah, and I guess I developed quite a good working relationship with Theresa. I'd known her for a long time. She said both elected at the same time. I'd served on a shadow ministerial team with her many years ago as well. But, you know, these are obviously sort of rather painful and uncomfortable things to broach. I guess it was not a huge surprise at that point. There had been a group of colleagues who had been openly campaigning to try to get the requisite number of letters written to me calling for no confidence vote. So, you know, I guess everybody thought it was likely to happen at some point. I just happened to be the person who was privy to the facts when a lot of other people in the media and in Parliament were just speculating. And, you know, I've said before, it was a remarkable thing to witness one or two of my colleagues appearing in the media saying that they'd written calling for a vote of no confidence when in fact they hadn't. So the people who were trying to keep a tally informally were basing it on very imperfect data. And, you know, even on the day that the threshold was crossed, as I've said before, I was given what I knew was the I think it was 48 letters I needed at the time to cross the threshold. I was given what I knew was the 48th letter by a colleague in a corridor in the House of Commons. I went back to my office and sat down to collect my thoughts and start planning what needed to be done. And just a few minutes later, another colleague knocked on my office door and came in and said, Graham, that letter I gave you a couple of weeks ago, can I have it back? I don't think it's the right time at the moment. So in the course of a day, we crossed the threshold and crossed back again. Right. And then again crossed the threshold. So it was a very odd time. I suppose I generally cope quite well with stress, but it was a little bit stressful.
Mm-hmm. And when Theresa May did resign in June 2019, many suggested that you should throw your hat in the ring for the party leadership. Why didn't you enter the contest when there was public support for your candidacy?
Well, there wasn't sufficient support, I think, was right. Because of the job that I've been doing as chairman of the 1922 committee, I clearly had to maintain complete impartiality. Mm-hmm. Would have been entirely wrong for me to go about canvassing support amongst Conservative MPs if I had been planning to stand if and when any vacancy arose. But then when I went to see the then Prime Minister Theresa May at number 10 to agree a date for her to stand down, she put me in a rather difficult position because she said, and before you leave this building, you need to announce whether you're going to be a candidate or not. And the reasoning was not crazy. I think the reasoning was that they wanted to put out an agreed statement of what the process for an election for a new leader would be. So, you know, at that point, I just thought, well, the only sensible thing for me to do is to recuse myself from the process, and I'll just go and talk to some colleagues and see what the demand is. And it seemed pretty clear to me that Boris Johnson was going to win hands down. And I therefore didn't think it was worth entering the contest. I think the result was pretty much what I expected.
I'd like to finish this interview by just coming back to looking at the legacy of lockdown and what the longer lasting lessons of the restrictions will be. And just wanted to ask you, do you think lockdown has made us, as the public, reassess our relationship with the state and rediscover our sense of personal responsibility after we have been placed under such stringent restrictions for so long?
I think it's a complete mixture, Nathan. I mean, I've been fascinated and slightly alarmed over the last 18 months looking at the different ways in which people have reacted to these sort of extreme limits on their freedom and liberty being introduced by government, there seems to be a significant part of the population that really quite likes being told what to do every minute aspect of their lives. I don't know whether they find it reassuring, but I think for many of us, it has come as rather an alarming revelation, the ease with which fundamental human rights and liberties can be taken away, and the difficulty that we see in trying to impose some proper limits on that, proper scrutiny of what government has been doing. I mean, it was only last September when I tried to table an amendment in the House of Commons that would require the government to seek parliamentary approval for the exercise of these powers. Nearly everything for the first 6 months was being done under emergency powers without either debates or votes in the House of Commons. It's remarkable how readily we let these freedoms be taken away from us. I hope that more people, as time goes on, will start to assess the impact of this and really think very deeply about the limits of what we should allow government to do.
Okay. So, Graham Brady, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.